You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and although you're hearing this on Wednesday the 19th, I'm recording this on location in South Carolina on my 50th birthday, the 18th of October. And it's weird. I have to admit, turning 50 is strange. You're not quite middle-aged anymore, but you're not old. It's a very odd situation, especially having been so ill. That's no way to start things off. Although, Myrtle Beach is not a bad place to recover. And again, as I said last time, I really appreciate the support of my friends throughout all this. You know, when your temperature goes above 103, you start to have some very dark, paranoid thoughts, and which frankly was the worst part of everything. And so your support has meant quite a bit, as it always does. And so, despite feeling very odd and very weird, I want to continue with what I did last week, and that is something that rarely gets discussed, and that is Byzantium, Constantinople, prior to Constantine, prior to the establishment of the seat of the Roman Empire in the East. And the deeper you get into this, the more you realize just how complex and how difficult it is. This confluence, I mean, this is one of the most strategic areas on the planet. We talked about the Bosphorus and how the seas connect, and this is really almost the gateway of the planet. And so controlling it was critical for anyone who wanted to matter. And we're also talking about the establishment of the Orthodox Empire. And God chose this area. So understanding its history has something to do with understanding why God chose it in the first place. And, of course, this is a Greek area, soon to come under Roman control. And don't forget, when the Byzantine Empire was established, the language was Latin. The language was Latin for a very long time. You know, Constantine is from Britain. Only as time went on and the two sides of the empire began to fall out, do you have Greek coming back. But at this time, Greek is, in a very broad sense, the language of the region. So in dealing with pre-Constantinople, the pre-Christian Byzantine Empire of Constantinople, it gets complicated. You're talking about any society or small empire that was able to control this very strategic area. And we move to Thrace, really, which ultimately, you know, Thrace in the northern hinterlands of Byzantium. And so many of these societies had the potential of becoming great empires, but didn't. There's a lot of pressure for anyone who wants to control this area. Thrace is one of these. The initial Thracian region, which would include, you know, Constantinople, the northern hinterland, was the home to related but not identical tribal federations. And even the Serbs may be included here. The Dacians, the Goths, and the Thracians appeared on the territory of modern Bulgaria. And to the west of them were the Celts, Germanic tribes to the north and the Greeks to the south. So settled agriculture is very early, which is extremely important, as many of you know. You have homes that are discovered maybe, you know, the 4th millennium BC along the Black Sea. So homes, you know, the rectangular square house, two rooms, stone and clay, wheat and barley dominated, and domesticated animals. And like you see in the Slavic areas, the center of the house is a stove. It's essential to rural houses, even today. And, well, you know, in the Russian case, it took a huge portion of the house, used for heating, used for everything. And these elements, what we would call even an apartment, remained intact. So Thrace was an area consisting of several tribes with their own fortifications. They had their high priests and monarchs. But as is so often the case in nation building, you can't really call them neighboring people because they were very similar. They had a unique relationship. This was a federation rather than just a mere collection of distinct peoples. This was Thracian. You have ancient buildings that are shaped in a pyramid type. You have temples, what we consider temples, in the territory of southeastern Europe and Asia Minor. The top is a carved pillar, but along the edges are these carved grooves that allow fluid to flow freely towards the gorge from the top, where, you know, living creatures sacrificed here. Was this the place where Dionysius, which would make a lot of sense, was venerated? And, of course, the drainage system as a means of pouring wine. Gold was deeply symbolic here. This, you know, as countries, as empires become wealthy, certain things get fetishized. Gold seems to be almost universally venerated, for lack of a better term. This was the way for power and immortality, the bridge between man and the spirit world. The Thracians buried treasures as offerings to gods that would consecrate the ground, would protect it from invasion, which is why this area is such a rich site for archaeological digs. Monarchs, such as they were forbidden to sell items that were part of his income and assets because they were no longer personal. They were social. The wealth of a Thracian ruler was like King Midas, who was a Thracian. Everything he touched turned to gold, which, of course, in and of itself is a huge problem. But these were the initial occupants of what would later become Constantinople and its hinterlands. But even the fine arts beyond that were clearly Greek. The relationship between these neighbors, they haven't always been positive. And the Thracians and Greeks came to blows many times. But then the Germanic tribes, or what we might call the Saxons, the Proto-Franks, and they lived traditionally throughout the Neolithic and Bronze Age. But you do also have written sources in Thrace. Land of the Thracians, named after the legendary nymph by the same name, the prophetess and healer. And even Homer mentions in the Iliad that the Thracians were a warrior people, allies of the Trojans. Herodotus wrote about them in the 5th century, Herodotus wrote about them in their era, where he argued that the Thracians, of a great population, ruled by a tribal, communal, and more or less democratic system, that, which is another way of saying aristocratic system, that stressed unanimous voting and consensus. And he also states very clearly that had they had a single monarch, they would have been far more powerful than they became. But colonization, as we spoke of, the Thracian coast, of course, led to collisions between Greeks and the Thracians. Homer speaks of their cities, Chalcidice, among other places, where in the 8th century they fought the Greeks for the capture of the most fertile places in this area. But Thrace, at the time, not really a single nation, but it was an area of very similar tribes. Even even Thucydides said that some Athenians were accused of treason and sentenced to death there. So they managed to escape to Thrace, where they lived for another 20 years. And Thucydides was impressed by the wealth of the kingdom. Said it was founded by King Cares I in the 5th century BC. and that that part nearest to present-day Constantinople surpassed all Europe in gold and circulating money. So much, however, is always the case here that was lost. Oral poetry is lost. The knowledge of Thracians and medicine are lost. We know about them from legends only. Thrace is called the land of the muses, the birthplace of the first musicians and poets, Orpheus, who occupies a central place in the culture of the Thracians, is also considered a renowned healer, founder of the religious and philosophical foundations of the state. He preached an ethnic unity, but an ethnic unity is sort of a stoic connection with cosmic law. But even beyond that, the limited monarch, when he died, his tomb was filled with a huge amount of earth, forming a mound, and they're found throughout Eurasia and the Mediterranean, serving really as a model of the cosmos, the early primordial conception of the world. But by the 4th century, Thrace finally did create an authoritarian regime under a single emperor. Now, the problem here, Herodotus said this was the problem, that this wasn't the case. This is a prerequisite for power. But the new office, the new royal office, was open to all classes. It was always being peppered with scandal, with discontent. You didn't have a royal family at all. So the monarch was forced to prove his worth, and as always, especially in relations with the nobility, where any man of high birth could encroach on his place. Anyone with any kind of fame could encroach on him. So the system that developed there was curious. You had a strong emperor, but not so strong as to be able to remove himself from the constant checks and balances of the upper classes, or let alone the generals of the army. Sleuthopolis is probably their most famous city, the construction of King Svet III, 4th century. Today, it's located at the bottom of the reservoir in the Valley of the Thracian Kings. But the technology is impressive. The streets intersect at right angles. Roads can be found. The city essentially was a fortress, the residence of the king priest. His palace also served as the main temple. And it shows that the standard of living there was above that of other peoples in Central and Eastern Europe. The kings wore armor. The helmets were made of gold and silver. Horses decorated with more than people. The Thracian kings were buried in graves, as we said. While so much of Europe was still living in semi-dugouts, and the culture was tremendous. And healing and medicine was something that made them very famous. And this became important because this is a civilization of warriors. You find in the grave sites, you find battle armor, helmets, harnesses, even whole chariots. Constant warfare, war as a daily routine. But this is what life is when you live in an area like this. And this is, I suppose, the closest we're ever going to get to the original inhabitants of Constantinople. And beyond all this, they rule the seas. They recognize the immense significance of the Golden Horn, due to the fact that it is a sheltered, easily defended harbor. And they circulated money. And we know the significance of that politically. They used the drachma, which was the entrance to the Greek island of Thassos. And the wealthy of the emperors minted their own coins, suggesting, of course, a gigantic market that was sea-based. And bronze coins were for the lower classes. Gold and silver coins were used for the higher-level transactions, and they use them for trade with different countries. The minted coins have symbols, ones that we can read, the ox, the horse, the double axe, which shouldn't be surprising given the nature of the culture. And there are some who want to talk about the origin of the double eagle with some of these coins as well. But, of course, Thrace never developed into the massive empire that they could have. Thrace was invaded by, of course, the Macedonian king Philip II, then Alexander, of course, the Persians, and then the Romans. Thrace represented the final stage of this Roman-style development and adopted its influence throughout Southern Europe. Thrace and Istanbul were Roman for roughly four centuries. Spartacus, in 71 BC, organized in the Apennine Peninsula. His famous slave revolt was the last of the famous Thracian gladiators. And even Alexander the Great, or so it said, thought that the priesthood could predict the future and believed it. And in gratitude for their assistance, he gave the priest a golden chariot weighing 800 pounds, which apparently remains in the mountains of Bulgaria. But we're at a stage here where Constantinople is already now globally famous. It's more and more critical to the economy of the area, which really at the time means greater and greater pressures put on anyone who rules it. The Euxine Pontus, the Sea of Marmara, the Black Sea, was the economic hub of society. The Golden Horn was essential. And this is the wide range of trade routes uniting the Mediterranean to the Black Sea. Anyone who controls this area will develop, and develop quickly. In the area, 4th century BC, you did have somewhat of a mixed population, but it was a Hellenistic place. You had the participation of mercenaries in battle, according to Hesiod, and they adopted the Hellenic way of life, gave them the experience of Greek military tactics and strategy. And, of course, very quickly, they created small colonies. But the size didn't make any difference. They founded Miletus, Lesbos, Miagras, Samos, and the Byzantium was on the Thracian bank of the Miagra, where the city was based on agriculture and trade, with many centers there, Athens included. And the economy depended on these harbor cities. It was trade-based. It was a merchant-based economy. But the hinterland can't be separated from the coastal cities. You had a dependent population inland formed under the control of the urban merchant class on the coast, which is never a good mix. But you see this massive spread of Greek products, ceramic and metallic goods, coins, of course, the evidence of the social consequences, the inclusion of Thrace in the trade of the Greek world is everywhere. This is also a challenge to the Thracian Empire. Its core isn't close to the Hellenic colonies or tribes that experienced the greatest radiation of the Greek economy. But it brought them into regular contact. So, that being said, and understanding the context here, someone else that we have to mention are the Aetolians in the Aetolian League. I promised last time that we would get into the nature of the league system. Anyone who studies ancient Greek life comes across these leagues all the time. The Athenian and the Spartan being the most famous, but there were many of these. And the most notable event in political life and political theory, one that still matters in our world, in the Black Sea Greek area, the development of these leagues, these unions. These are more than tribal alliances. These large associations with the Peloponnesian states, a Delian League. You had this in the Archaic and the Classical Age. But only as you come to within a few centuries of the Christian era, they become the leading form of political organization. In the Hellenistic period, leagues of the older type continued to exist. And their purpose was to strengthen the state, of course. They're preparing a ruling class for wide hegemonic power and organizing a new civic life. So, for example, the Greeks repeatedly tried to revive the League of Corinth created by Philip II after the Battle of Chersone. So in 302 BC, the Union was revived under Demetrius, but after his defeat, the Union collapsed immediately. 224 BC, another attempt to revive the League of Corinth was made by the King of Macedonia, but it ultimately proved unsuccessful. These were not easy to pull off because these were hegemonic unions and there was always concern with who's going to share with what. Hegemony of Macedonia at the time seemed very disappointing and it didn't last very long. Macedonia didn't have a sufficient military or economic base, upon which any long-term hegemonic control over all Greece could be possible, at least at the time. But we've been talking about all this time, I've been droning on about building this economic base and what it's based on, what it has to be based on. There was the island league at Delos, the African leagues formed under the Ptolemies later on. And then some of the more powerful, you had leading states like Locris, Phocis, Bataia, Cephalia, Epirus, Eubolia, even the Achaean state itself. The entire territory of Greece was divided amongst these various unions. They were stronger than tribes, of course, but not nearly as unified. But most of these were not openly hegemonic. They remained in their normally accepted borders, and the members were generally equal. But apart from the Delian, you had the Achaean and the Aetolian League. Outside of the unions were only Athens and Sparta, that the latter finally had to enter the Achaean League to plug into sufficient economic power to take Athens, which was part of how these things were being used. Multinational bodies are useful only if they increase the hegemonic power of a tribe, of a group. Otherwise, they're useless. And they don't get listened to unless they're stronger. No different than the UN today. You could ignore the UN because no one really cares. But the political structure of the unions imitated the political philosophy of the Greek polis. You had a body of the National Assembly, which was allegedly supreme, but there were councils and magistrates in the administrative system, we would call the executive branch. And from this developed the idea of the all-union citizenship. And you had a humane tenor of all of these. None of these led to the creation of a consolidated state. So their component parts maintained independence. Each of the units kept their territory, their political organization, and nationality, even as these nationalities were forming into larger entities like Greek. But the political, it was the political imperfection of the leagues, the coexistence of the league and the polis structures, but these were characteristic, and these were one of the constant causes of internal weakness, and whoever could overcome that the first was going to win, which, of course, was always the case. So when creating these alliances, the usual constitution focused on citizens, the citizens of the polis, and their rights to acquire landed property in the territory of others, when that was solidified by marriages among citizens of different states. And there was a certain equality before the law, or else there'd be no purpose in joining a league. That leagues were popular among oligarchs is beyond any doubt. But the expansion of manor holdings wasn't the only purpose. The reasons for the establishment, again, oligarchs only care about these things so long as there's not a strong monarch to keep them in their place. The reasons for the establishment of the league, generally speaking, any league, arose from the need to resist an external threat. In particular, the Macedonian, which was, despite all these problems, were consolidating. The polis was fairly small and exclusive. The widely recognized right to purchase the property or purchase property allowed for the older clan structure to either break down or to become more inclusive. So ultimately, the league is an outgrowth of land ownership. But it doesn't mean it didn't have positive implications. Building alliances did not lead to the overcoming of any kind of regional disintegration, and past rivalries among hundreds of polities now resulted in, well, an equally permanent enmity among leagues. But the Aetolians lived in the mountains, unfortified cities, the villages, scattered homes in the countryside, and they were isolated from each other. Aetolia was based only on the southern littoral of fertile plains, suitable for agriculture. The remaining space was mountainous, and you really only had, you know, hunting and herding were the only things you could possibly do there. Therefore, they developed a very austere lifestyle, and it reminds me a little bit of Montenegro, in that they preserved the old militancy, the rough freedom of the archaic Greek period. But the Aetolians, like so many of the mountain people, were known for their bravery, and over time, engaged in predatory raids, led by its elite and noble militias, and even went so far as harassing the shores of Italy and Asia Minor. Nevertheless, the Aetolians for some time led a very primitive but very respectable life. but it was in the classical era, 367 BC, the Aetolian League was formed. And it was considered the one of the so-called backward regions of Greece. It didn't have a central power. And as I said, its population lived in villages and self-sufficient communes. The military was constantly and actively engaged against Macedonia, and Aetolia was able to gain control of a large part of central Greece, including the most important, the pan-Hellenic sanctuary of Delphi. Now, during the Celtic invasion, the Aetolians were able to defend this sanctuary, which increased their prestige amongst Greeks tremendously. And included in there, the league was Boeotia, a significant part of Thessaly, two additional states. But its influence was far greater. It went so far as Asia Minor. Some areas of central Greece joined this federation. The constitution of the league promised that no member will be, unlike the Spartan situation, will be subject to any kind of Aetolian domination. So in this case, the austere warrior ethic of the mountains served them very well. And people tend to underestimate those kind of populations, as you've seen in the Montenegrin example. Like so many of the leagues, the political system had a people's assembly. Meetings were convened twice a year. But you could have extraordinary meetings too. The prerogative of the National Assembly was to declare war and peace, which is always their main concern, and all league legislation. It was open to all citizens, both in its selection and composition, and citizenry had a tendency to be based to a great extent on military prowess. But beyond that, there is also evidence that it was based primarily also on property qualification. But the two things tended to go together. The assembly, like so many of these at the time, had the heads of tribal and regional elites, initially had 550 members, and it was increased to 1,000. Like the Spartan case, the executive power was military. And those leaders in the executive were elected strictly from the assembly. And again, I think the aesthetic lifestyle led to a fairly structured, very disciplined military that expanded quickly. And so you couldn't really maintain regular sessions of the assembly, given the great distances involved. And they couldn't function continuously, so they created a special commission. It was far less representative, placed in charge of the daily life of the union. This is essentially now an executive entity. They could enter into relations with foreign states, give orders to the army, and its meetings were closed. But in Aetolia, because of a lot of this, oligarchy was checked. Land ownership became more focused and concentrated. Remember, oligarchs desired democracy, never an open oligarchy. So we use the term at this era, democracy meant an acceptable legal representation of all major elites essentially coming to consensus on policy. Very different from liberal democracy used today. By the end of the 3rd century BC, you had a dramatic increase in the number of poor, and they were called irredeemable debtors. So as currency comes to develop, so does debt. The more monetization penetrates the countryside, the more debt you get, and the more powerful the oligarchs become. Now, unlike other examples we've seen here, the military elites, many of whom were from the peasantry themselves, sought to cancel these. And they formed a populist movement. And as always, the oligarchs were able to organize. And within the commission, they fought one another. And eventually, the populists were forced to leave the area. This is what mercenaries can do. The slogan, of course, was fighting Macedonian tyranny. And therefore, this is how the League justified its enlargement. So, citizen 275, very close to Byzantium, Aeolus, the citizens of that area, expelled the Macedonian garrison and entered into the League. So Aeolus then became the capital of the Achaean League, despite its small size. But its closeness to Byzantium and the Horn gave it even more significance. This small force, again, was able to develop quickly. Even Argos in 229 fell to the League. the Achaeanly, the whole Peloponnese was united except Sparta. And, you know, again, the core was Achaea itself, the Achaeanly. 280 BC, considered another so-called backward region north of the Peloponnese. But you had, you know, Argos and Corinth as part of this league. And so the Achaean League, really known from secondary sources anymore. Polybius, who was an Achaean ethnically, never left a description of its constitution. It was distinct from the Aetolian, but Polybius did praise the Achaean as a bastion of freedom. And his support for the League was genuine. But also he does mention that the policy of the League was directly mainly to support the property classes in the Peloponnesian cities. So age and property qualifications prevented the poor citizens participating in the League of the National Assembly. And everything else was usually fairly secret. As you might imagine, and you see this in American history too, the Achaean League went back and forth between that of a federation, and that of centralization. But the trend towards unity had a strongly, what we might call, humanistic idea of citizenship, the so-called old league citizen and rights that were developing in theory, and a joint treasury for military purposes, and the regime coined its own money. But that began to lose out, and depending on who the executive was, it would wax and wane. See, part of the reason that smaller states would join these leagues is that they would then preserve their autonomy that way. Otherwise, they're too small to defend themselves. Although there was a concept of an all-union citizen, citizenship in a more restricted, localized form continued to persist. There's not much they can do about it. So the Achaean League, despite its power, remained a fairly loose association, which limits its ability to expand. So in the words of Polybius, the League can put up 30 to 40,000 men in the field at any given time. But more and more, as time went on, they began to find themselves absorbed into the Macedonian kingdom. And quickly building fortresses and garrisons were to maintain any kind of patriotic or separatist movement. And this is one of the places where so-called philosophical cosmopolitan began to develop, something that became popular amongst the Stoics later on. And as this began to decay, as the system began to decay, one of the signs, of course, were, as he says, vulgar pleasure, performances, festival, abstract intellectual interest. These were symbols of the destruction of the League, distracting leading citizens from serious concerns. And Polybius talks about this in his history, that these leagues come to a sad end as Greece begins to, these leagues begin to fall apart. Even in Sparta, the constitution, the ancient constitution, began to lose its vitality, and what was a military system began to become an oligarchic system. And believe it or not, Spartans, of all people, began to use mercenaries, and their martial skill began to fade. Now, in Aetolia, you still had towns and counties having a strong tradition of aristocratic governance. Uniting them was a federal structure, but it was weak and a little too undeveloped for any real independence. So the way that the Macedonians were able to finally be victorious over these really was made possible when the power of the other Greek states was destroyed by wars, their energy wasted in the habits of ostentation. This is what oligarchy does. This is where Macedonian power comes from. Empires don't absorb these places unless these other places become decadent somehow. And this is what happens. Success is as much of a destructive power as failure. You know, the leagues, wherever they may go, it was a compromise. A region can't be conquered by one power, since most of the cities were more or less equal. The league institutionalizes that equality and then combines it with a military machine far stronger than any of the members could ever do alone. The member states retain domestic independence and give up military control only in times of war that they decide. So the two leagues still maintain rivalry and jealousy, and any kind of unity between the two we've been speaking of, were torn apart. But had it been able to last, the mutually benefits, the enriching benefits of Byzantine trade, that connection, would have maintained a very strong empire in times of peace. But the league, the federative system, simply wasn't strong enough to do this. And this is a continued problem. And I hope by now you're starting to grasp where the Byzantine idea came from. Byzantine idea cannot be separated, I mean, despite its Roman connection, which obviously is essential. This is the history where the empire fully was able to understand and build on. The League was a dominant form of political organization and political theory, and a tremendous amount of political ideas came out of them. It may be a very bad example, I'm not sure if this is a good example or not, but the Articles of Confederation in the U.S. are vaguely something along the lines of what we mean by a league. The difference being the Articles, the states unified by the Articles, were really separate from any other major power, and were not connected like in a very, very busy area, very dangerous area, as Greece and the Balkans. Still, it's something similar. I've always been a supporter of Daniel Shays and the Shays Rebellion that tended to lean towards the Articles, which were not as bad as the Federalists said. But still here, it was centralized enough for an oligarchy to form, not centralized enough for any strong populist monarch to take over. So at its worst, the League system had the worst of both worlds. And this is one of the reasons it faded into existence. And ultimately, with Roman domination, as the Republic began to wane, as it should have, someone like Sulla, the beginning of the empire, showed that this is the kind of executive necessary for any kind of stable system. One other place that goes into building the Byzantine system is Pergamon, located in the northwestern part of Asia Minor. This is now called the Caicos, now called the Barclay River. It's the main city. State itself was founded by the son of Attilus in 283 BC and created the dynasty, the Attilids. And Attilus I, Eumenides II, extended the limits of this kingdom and captured a large portion of Asia Minor's interior. And the kingdom of Pergamon became one of the largest and wealthiest of the Greek states, which of course also played a big role in the building of what became the Byzantine Empire, and a pivotal role in the fate of the Hellenistic world at the end of the 2nd century. But the people, again, Hellenistic, originated Asia Minor, many Greek cities, of course, heavily Hellenized long before the conquests of Alexander. We're talking about places like Cilicia, Lydia, Pergamon. It made itself unique as the Greek population began to mix with Oriental peoples in, you know, the general Turkish area. And this intermixing, though, ended up building an economy that still had classical marks. The use of slaves in many sectors of the economy, the introduction of very labor-intensive methods, land exploitation, and a respectable commodity market. And these are the things that create nations, for better or for worse. The economic prosperity of Pergamon is also due to the mild climate, fertile soil. We're in a valley here. You got river valleys, low hills, vineyards, olive trees, rich pastures. And, of course, her strategic location near Byzantium and the Black Sea made her wealthy quickly. She had every variable going for it in building a successful state. But like other Hellenistic monarchs, the royal family declared most of the land as royal property, and farmers were seen as tenants paying taxes and supporting public duties, which is not anywhere near the same thing as serfdom, because that would imply a private manor system. These are citizens. The bureaucracy, high military as always, on these lands, they did arise, large estates worked by slave labor. But Greek cities under the classical polis did have that kind of system. Your soldier mercenary were allocated plots and special settlements, also worked by slaves. And in general, the life of the private farms in Pergamon was more profitable than the states of the Ptolemies and other Greek areas. And it was also highly monetized. High share of trade, crafts, commodity production, really the healthiest of the Greek states, and a balanced economic life. She became known as a very powerful handicraft area, very high quality. I mean, jewelry, parchment, fabrics, all of this. The Attalid's brocade, which became very famous, gold thread, and her weapons were universally in demand. You had this huge surplus, and she then dominated the trade routes of the Eastern Mediterranean and the Black Sea. The potential wealth here is almost infinite. Didn't take long for this to become the wealthiest city of the Greek world. But you did have all these rapid development systems. You had the Greek Macedonians at the top, the local nobility and the subservient class. But the nobility before the campaigns of Alexander was well acquainted with Greek civilization in places like Macedonia. But the ruling class was more united in the states of the Ptolemies than, which made them very hard to fight. I could say the same thing for Spartans. But the administration and the army were not tied to families at all. Farming in the countryside was very profitable, but the development of the bureaucracy in Pergamon led to a certain independence of the ruling class. This never grew to a tightly centralized system. The local nobles, who had an interest in a greater accumulation of wealth and maintaining social order, ultimately, and we've seen this elsewhere, looked to Rome for protection. The dynasty quickly became unstable. Rome was increasingly seen as a strong, a bastion of stability, which she was. So that alliance would solidify the nobility against any bourgeois middle-class element that might seek to overthrow the titled nobility. So the organization of the state, to use words defined back then, was more democratic and its monarchy more popular than in most cities. There was no cult of the monarch. There was no so-called deification of royal power. I mean, they called themselves citizens of Pergamon, not kings. On the other hand, successor states of Alexander, the Ptolemies, etc., used phrases like "we command," but phrases like that were never used in any of the executive legislation elsewhere. The Attalid administration was small. They were never capable of dominating society. In fact, no state ever built a bureaucracy large enough to dominate much of anything. The Seleucids, the Ptolemaic society, army personnel had great privileges and influence in the affairs of state. So that means that you had a regime of Greeks and Macedonians opposed to local interests. But in Pergamon, you had the mercenary army. It didn't play a political or social role like that. They were foreigners. And so they could be raised at will, meaning that, of course, cash could buy security. And their foreign policy reflected all of this. The Ptolemies, the Seleucids, all the second century BC, they began to lose one area after another. The Attalids, by contrast, would increase their ownership and turn their small country into a great power. Their holdings covered almost all of Asia Minor. Again, very rapid expansion. But that relied on the support of Rome to happen. Macedonia was weakened as a result. It was defeated by Rome in the Battle of Magnesia in 190 BC. The Seleucids were forced to abandon the area. And Pergamon took over in Asia Minor. So the cooperation and the destruction of these Roman enemies of Rome was very mutually beneficial. So you had a creation then, once this became well known, the creation of a hostile coalition against Pergamon, the coalition of Bithynia, Galatea, Cappadocia, Pontus. This changed everything. And they forced the last king, Attalus III, 139-133, bringing the kingdom directly under Rome. But that led to a significant explosion of popular indignation by the son of Attalus, Aristonic, led this rebellion. And the rebellion was brutally repressed by the Roman regular troops. And this was their, you know, the cities were captured. He was strangled in a Roman prison. The site of the former kingdom of Pergamum, the Romans founded the province of Asia and radiating directly from there. So, again, you've seen this pattern here. Greek or slightly mixed city-states growing very rapidly, but with rapid growth, tremendous social divisions that eventually led to irrational policy, which led to self-destruction. Ultimately, Rome ended up being the only winner here. Most of these were colony-building powers, but the Attalids were not. They produced fewer colonies in other states. They did support a few of them, like Ilea, harbor area, a handful of others, and of course Pamphylia, a few other places, Black Sea areas, but nothing like what, you know, Athens did. Like the Ptolemies, they were patrons of arts and sciences, attracting scholars and artists. Parchment was invented in Pergamum, produced from goat and donkey skins. And Attalus was just, you know, immensely successful. This was able to compete with Alexandrian cities anywhere. And you know, you still have the ruins of the temple that still exist. Allies of the Romans here against Antioch to the south. After Magnesia, these guys were greatly rewarded. And Rome ceded much of Asia, Asia Minor, to the city, taken away from a rich city like Antioch. But this, of course, was not a sustainable type of foreign policy. This was not a part of the league. Pergamon was authoritarian. It was authoritarian. It was a wealthy kingdom. Unfortunately, that required Roman weapons to ensure its own position. The point, of course, is what we now know as Byzantium. In this case, two strong centralized states, if allied, could finally bring the Golden Horn into its full potential, which really was the gateway into the world. But rivalry, the desire for power, ultimately won out. But what incentive did Rome have to keep the potentially rebellious city around if the resistance was destroyed? It would only have invited a domestic clique to overthrow the Roman rulers and to install a Greco-file one. And this was the option chosen by the man who came closest. Prior to Rome and unifying the area, and we've spoken about him before, Mithridates, in the four or five ways to pronounce his name, in the crisis we talked about in the last time, in the second century, as these systems rose and fell, and pressure not only from Rome, but also from the east. We mentioned Pontus and Bithynium. And, you know, we had Pharnak I, the rise of the Pontus kingdom, 170 BC, roughly, captured Sinope, as we discussed, making it the capital of his state, aggressive trade policy. And so this laid the foundations of this very powerful Black Sea power close to the Christian era. And Mithridates, the fifth of Pontus. And of course, his far more famous, his grandson, the sixth, with the help of a dynastic marriage, he strengthened his influence in Cappadocia. And he did seek to maintain friendship with the Romans. But he did this by contributing men to the Third Punic War, and the revolts in return were repressed. That Mithridates V created an ethnic foundation. It was a Greek national state. Whether it be, you know, merchants, soldiers, Greek generals, a great level of ethnic solidarity. This is one of the reasons that this society developed. But fortifying Pontus, because of all of this, it did threaten the Roman Republic. Once Pergamon was destroyed, Rome began to see Pontus as now its potential enemy. You even had, under Mithridates V, you had a Latinophile pro-Latin policy. Latinophiles eventually led to his own murder. And this is where Mithridates VI, his son came in. Sorry, I said grandson before. And was convinced after this that Rome was the enemy. You had a tremendous ethnic division. You had a tremendous political division. And he strengthened the regimes. One of the reasons that he is so famous. Rome itself, though, had fallen on hard times. The hordes descended on Italy from Germany, the Cimbri, the Teutons, etc., threatening to destroy Rome itself. The internal situation in places like the slave revolts in Sicily. Rome never had the sufficient forces at the time to prevent Mithridates, from expanding his power at the expense of the territories of Asia Minor. You know, Pergamon had fallen. He took advantage. But Rome wasn't strong enough to do much about it. We spoke of the Scythian threat, but this abated. And places like Kherson, Olbia, Tyre, and Byzantium itself sought to be incorporated into the kingdom of Pontus. There, they'd be defended. Mithridates, of course, a brilliant leader. About 80 BC, the Greek cities of the Western Black Sea joined him, which meant a lot of money. Parts of Asia Minor came to the Greek, who was a Greek nationalist. All large areas, Paphlagonia, Galatia, Phrygia, all these places. Before the spring of 133, the childless king we talked about, Attila III, he bequeathed his throne to Rome, as we already talked about, and the rebellion occurred. Well, there wasn't going to be much left afterwards. Mithridates on Pontus took the area. Bithynia received a chunk of the area too. But Mithridates considered himself an equal to Rome, and he used this rebellion to expand his own territory. He began to build secretly, actually, this coalition, enlisting the support of local elites. And they had a choice to make. Now it was either him or Rome. With certain places looking for Rome for help. But with the Cimbri War, there's not much they can do. And prior to Alexander, the Cappadocia and Pontus were part of a single Persian satrapy. But relations had always been very good. But through some marriages, Mithridates was able to build a large army. I mean, 80,000 infantrymen, 10,000 horsemen. He was building Egyptian-style chariots to defend himself. And this empire, this Greek empire, took over much of the area. And with Rome being tremendously occupied, there's not much really they can do. And Roman Asia eventually responded by forming three armies, recruiting from the same, the Bithynia and Galatia area, under the authority of Cassius. And apparently, Mithridates had an army of 250,000, which is probably an exaggeration. He had 300 warships, because all this time he's building this coalition. He had allies in parts of Egypt, Syria, Armenia. Even the Thracian tribes threw in their lot with him. The Romans were badly defeated. And as far as the Greek population goes, Mithridates treated the local Greek population as friends. He maintained their trust. Slaves were set free all over the place. Debts were canceled for 5 years, sometimes permanently. But his treatment of Romans was different. I mentioned this the last time. In 88, he obliged his officers to eliminate Italians, regardless of their age, leaving their corpses exposed, which is a huge sign of disrespect. And probably a very stupid thing, a so-called Asian Vespers. This is how he consolidated his ideological image. And then Mithridates decided to join his possessions to Greece, of course, using the Bosporus as a link between them. Now he is part of Byzantine history. Many of you know how this ends, where Sulla was used to finally deal with what was a very large empire. Seleucids, Rhodians, assembling a fleet and in the Aegean, and finally went after him. Separating Mithridates from the sea was the strategy, and he laid siege eventually to Athens, which he made his capital. And of course, a full scale slaughter of the Greeks began as a response. Still, Mithridates was not quite finished. You had two legendary commanders, Coronea. The Coronea battle showed this. Mithridates was a populist and a nationalist, and that bore fruit. You had thousands of volunteers, freed slaves. His ranks grew. But of course, Sulla had the advantage of Roman martial discipline, close formation tactics, as many of us have read and understood over the years. And his new consul, Lucius, moved his headquarters to Byzantium, and Sulla began to win, trying to destroy his nemesis personally. But his opponent did escape, forcing yet another war for control of the Greek population, the Second Mithridatic War, in the spring of 80. He had fled to the Bosporus, but the local population rebelled against what they considered to be the Greek invader. He understood how colossal the control of Byzantium was, and Sulla and the Roman Senate made sure that it was going to be sympathetic to the Latins, doing to them what Mithridates did to the Greek population. But there was no agreement with the Roman population, with the Roman Republic. One of the things that happened, even the pirates had gone over to the Greeks. Mithridates, along with the Armenian monarch, Tigran II, he had a coalition now of Scythians, he had Sarmatians, he had Thracians, all brought under Greek control by a formal treaty. And the pirates, the pirate forces, which were substantial, close to Byzantium, supported the Greeks over the Latin. Cyprus, Crete, these were pirate ports. They had a seasoned navy, not to mention the Greeks, and they gave the Romans absolutely no peace. This was a tottering republic at this point. And Mithridates, his men were already mastering the Roman formations like the turtle. They used a siege tower. One of the things that brought him down, helped bring him down, was a plague. Brought on by a drought, destroyed the Greek forces. 70-69, instead of by 67, the Greek monarch was wounded, still defeated the Romans, but that went without consequence. His campaign was broken off until he was healed. The Greek forces were based entirely on his personality, which is very dangerous. Mithridates retook Cappadocia, but he had rebellions all over the place. He had the superior resources of Rome to contend with. Asian Armenian had rebelled. The new commander, Pompey, marched against Mithridates, 50,000 infantry, but by this time, he had no real discipline. Yes, it's true. Pontius, suffered a crushing defeat. Mithridates eventually fled, where he, by his final last stand with 3,000 men, had to face the new Armenian monarch who was pro-Roman. And we know what happened, of course. Rome won. The rest is Roman. A century into the Christian era, people still didn't understand what Byzantium could accomplish as a strategic asset. All of these wars, all of these empires, small and large, built themselves along the Byzantine realm, the Byzantine area, the Byzantine world, the Golden Horn, these ports. Mithridates is a penultimate character. I realized like a Rome-style society was absolutely needed to extract the best advantage out of the Golden Horn. No other system is going to work. The leagues weren't going to work. None of these were going to work. But Mithridates, father and son, he was as talented, he was unscrupulous. Because it was based on their personalities, they didn't have the bureaucracy that the Romans did. Had they developed one, the deaths of those two military geniuses would have mattered very little to the peace of the area. And from here, as we all know, soon, the Romans in the West under Constantine, we'll come to understand how important the Greek world is. This was the Christian Empire. This is what this region had to go through to build the Byzantine political idea. The leagues had failed. Tribal systems had failed. Mithridates was very successful, except that there was no way to make this permanent. This is something that Byzantium absolutely learned. This was the classical history that every elite in that society had to study. Mithridates came close, and he was a genius. He was an ethno-nationalist, at least in his language, in his formal policy, and he used it. But there was one thing necessary that was missing, and that was a bureaucracy, an actual state that can outlive him. You could have great leaders, but as soon as they're gone, the system falls apart. And people, far lesser people, try to gain control over what they have created. The whole point of a bureaucratic state, in the best sense of the term, is that while it could use the talents of a great leader, it's not dependent on a great leader. The great leader can die, and the system will still function. This is what Rome did. This is one of Rome's great contributions to the world. And Mithridates, once the leagues were destroyed, the oligarchies were destroyed, showing themselves to be failures, Mithridates came the closest. Rome won, not just because of the plague, not just because of military defeat and drought and all this, using ethno-nationalism. The Romans did the same thing. The Sicilian Vespers, which was a very stupid idea. It wasn't just that. It had nothing to do with that. It had to do with building a bureaucracy, a state. This is where the modern state came from. It simply can't exist in the hands of one leader, because he's going to die. This is essential everywhere. It has to outlive the leader. The leader has to be a legislator that creates the state. To some extent, you did have it in Sparta on a far smaller scale, but we saw even what happened there. And of course, he made many mistakes. The standardized system of a bureaucracy keeps that from happening. This is where the Byzantine state came from. This is where, to a great extent, the Roman state came from. They learned quite a bit of this from this area of war. Anyway, this has been a thumbnail sketch of pre-Christian Byzantium, Constantinople, what life was like in the Golden Horn and who tried to control it, and why the Roman Empire took the form it did, and why, of course, the Byzantine Empire took the form it did. This is extremely, critically important history for the development of Christian Europe. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.